Blog Talk Radio.
I'm just so broke, you won't believe. Can't get a dollar out of me. And as far as I can see, I'm losing control like a bad disease. No, I just can't get relief. I've been shot down by the life police. Cause every day I try to rise, but I can't succeed. Can anybody find a cure for me? You can be bitter, bitter, bitter. Or you can be better, better, better. Great life gives you lemon. Instead of champagne. Now every day is like a brand new year. I throw my hands up in the air like I just don't care. I'm moonwalking down the street feeling like, oh yeah, oh yeah. Well, at the bottom of the gas now, I see clear. So now I laugh just a little more. I'm so much taller than I did before. I know I'm not where I need to be. But I thank God that I'm not where I used to be. I used to be bitter, bitter, bitter. But now I feel better, better, better. Great life gives you lemon. Instead of champagne. No worry, little children. I don't complain. Whoa, remember your folding. Your body don't sugar cane. Great life gives you lemon. Take lemonade.
Come on, come on, come on, come on, come on.
I would say for a reason that I can't explain. Got something new to believe in. I'm awakened again. How many miracles I have seen each day. If I can just get out of my own way. Well, life gives you lemon. Instead of champagne.
I'm a man of many talents. I'm more talented than Alex Boyer. More people ask for my autograph than for him. They're not going to tell you that. That little, like, rap part, where we're like, no, 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 lemonade, so dumb. It's already been done, like, a billion times. But luckily, I was in the shot, because I saved it. Redemption. You're welcome, Alex.
The lemon song that I play when I open my show. This is your host, Gail St. Francis Johnson, formerly known as Miss Delicious. Okay, my show is a show for the tame and the untamed. It's serious with a dash of humor. Life is what you make it. You may be rich but unhappy or broken happy. You may have had many adversities in your life. How many pity parties did you have? Ever went from being a victim to becoming victorious? Ever been down so low you could swing your legs on a dime? Do you have a sense of humor? Ever laughed at yourself? What is your overall view of life? Want to vent? Just have something to get off your chest? If you answered yes to one of these questions, this show is for you. on my show, you get free exposure if you're a business owner, starting a business, author, expert, or just want to share information of importance. I invite you to come on as a guest and let's chop it up. Sorry, there'll be no discussion, religion, or politics. And if you're interested in becoming a co-host on my show, email me at gjdelicious37@gmail.com. Again, that email address is gjdelicious37@gmail.com. Okay, it was a rainy day down here in North Carolina, but it was a beautiful day because I woke up in it regardless. And hope you guys are having a beautiful evening this evening because I have a very special guest this evening. I'm going to tell you a little bit about him before I bring him on. His name is Bryant Leslie, and he's a nationally recognized expert in coercive interrogation, testifying in America's highest profile cases. Bryant Leslie is a former chief of police and nationally recognized expert in coercive interrogation and interview techniques. He has conducted more than 2,000 interviews and interrogation during his 14-year career in policing. He testifies regularly and is qualified as a forensic expert in state, federal, and military courts throughout the United States. Mr. Leslie will educate listeners on how and why people confess to crimes they did not commit. He will also explain how faulty identifications of suspects occur and how flawed police investigations are responsible for charging the wrong suspects in some cases. Mr. Leslie's expert testimony has educated many jurors and courts throughout the United States over the years and allowed them to return favorable verdicts for wrongly and accused charged individuals. Mr. Leslie's expert testimony has aided in restoring justice and fairness in these cases and ultimately preempt a serious miscarriage of justice. As police agencies today are being placed under microscope, this topic has been trending for some time nationally. Listeners will gain valuable factual information on why suspects are wrongly targeted, interrogated, and ultimately charged. Now, all that sounds very, very interesting, especially what's going on today. And I'm quite sure if you, my listening audience have any questions, I really would appreciate if you would make a comment or ask Mr. Bryant a question. So without further ado, we're going to bring on Bryant Leslie.
Hey, Gail, how are you tonight?
I'm fabulous, darling. And yourself?
Good, good, good. Happy to be on your show. Your audience. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, I mean I was going to say that's very good because I'm happy to have you on here. You know, just like I had mentioned, especially what we're going through now with the police and you know, different things that are going on right now. You know, perhaps you can answer some of those questions as well as the other questions that I'm going to ask you too.
Oh, sure. And one of the things that your listeners should know, number one, is it's a fairly complicated scenario that you're going to be dealing with. And I'm going to kind of explain it and break it down just like I would with juries. How's that tonight?
Oh, that sounds good. Sounds really good. So I have some questions that I want to ask you. You know, how and why people confess to crimes they did not commit?
Well, that's a question that even the lawyers ask me constantly. In fact, I've had lawyers say to me and called me up and said, you know, my client has been charged. I told them, don't say anything to the police. Next thing you know, he's giving a confession to the police. I don't believe it. I can't imagine why he would do that. Well, I'll explain some things to you. First of all, most people that are considered to be innocent in their own minds, whether or not they may have been culpable to some degree, but generally speaking, they feel that they haven't committed anything. They're more than willing to try to help the police. They believe when they walk into an interview room, and let's not call it an interrogation room, because I'm going to tell you what the difference between an interrogation is and an interview, first of all. An interview basically is fact-finding. It's done during a course of an investigation. It's done with witnesses. It's a collection of physical evidence. It's talking to witnesses. It's talking to corroborating some witnesses. And the difference between an interrogation is that an interrogation is accusatory in nature, the purpose for which there's a presumption of guilt going into an interrogation to believe that that particular individual is a suspect and that that individual committed the crime that is alleged to have been committed. It's not an interview by no means. However, in the course of elements of an interrogation, the individual may think and believe that he is in fact a witness or a person of interest that is coming in to clear his name and want to assist with police. And so most of the time, what happens is most of these interrogations will always start off as what appears to be an interview, believing that the suspect believing that he's perhaps unfairly targeted and wants to clear his name. So he gets in, he starts talking to the police. The first portion of an interrogation is always the rapport building process, which can take somewhere in the vicinity of even 20 minutes to even 2 hours in some cases, where basically the walls are dropped between the officer and the individual. And so there's a belief by the individual that the police really are trying to assist this individual in helping him, and he's helping the police. It's a reciprocal situation where the individual then starts talking and he's asked questions. Now, these questions, a lot of people don't understand. The questions, there's such things as what's known as narrative traps, and these are questions that are basically constructed by the police, that no matter how you answer it, it's always going to be incriminating. So the fact that the individual doesn't even see it coming, he sees a question that's being asked, maybe it's a general question that's only specific to a specific element of, let's say, for instance, an individual that they may know or they may have some contact with, but it's done in such a way that it is constructed, so no matter how he answers it, it shows that he had some culpability. And based on those, then there's a lot of other elements which are coercive in nature, and we're going to talk about it a little bit, is minimizations, which is minimizing the culpability to the individual. No, look, you didn't do anything wrong. It's not that bad. Murders up here, what you did is way down there, making him believe that basically it's just a minor thing that they're investigating. It's not such a big deal. Then comes the maximization. Maximizing is overstating the strength of the case. Look, we have lots of evidence against you. We have lots of witnesses. And they don't have to tell the truth during this period of time. They can totally lie about that stuff. We have lots of evidence that we have videos in the area. We have your face on video, baiting him into a point where, for example, he believes that he's in a situation where he's now in a no-hope situation where he believes that he's getting railroaded, and he denies, and the more he denies, the officer will start talking about, we just want you to tell the truth. Now, what he's talking about is not the truth, it's the officer's truth, the investigator's truth, and that truth may be flawed because of the investigative process that they took, and I'm going to talk about a little bit about inductive and deductive investigative methods. Inductive or deductive simply means that they target an individual, they target an investigation, they only allow evidence that is inculpatory in nature, not exculpatory. They disallow anything that comes into the narrative that's not going to be what they want. An inductive method simply means you accept all information, you vet the information, you vet the source of the information, and then you go back and you then draw inferences based on that information, and as a result of that, you draw what's known as reasonable conclusions. That's an appropriate way to conduct an investigation, which is very seldomly ever done. Now, if we get go ahead. Any questions, I'll stop.
No, I was going to say, so a person can come in and make a confession. Now, they know that they didn't really commit this crime, but the police, they're taking it that the person did commit the crime, or do they also know that this person isn't the suspect?
No, absolutely not. And what happens in most cases is you'll, and a good example of that is the police have a crime. They have suspects that they have drawn perhaps through their own targeting, which they believe that they've been after for some period of time. That might be a possibility. A witness may have suggested that they might have been involved. And based on what that witness, the credibility of that witness, which they didn't vet that well, they may believe that witness. And therefore, they're going to draw what's known as a conclusion, and they're going to target that theory in their investigation. Now, it may be an improper theory only because they didn't vet the witness properly. That witness may have some sort of stake in the outcome. A good example of that is a blackout confession. It's called a blackout confession. And what happens in blackout confessions is during the rapport period, which the officer is building rapport with the individual, he'll start making up different things. Like, for example, oh yeah, when I was a kid, we used to drink a lot. And I remember blacking out many times, the officer would say, and maybe he may have been a nerd when he was in school, but this is all just show. And the individual will start comparing his stories, and he'll say, well, how about you? Did you ever black out? Did you ever drink? So, oh, yeah, because he knows he's an alcoholic. He knows he's a drug user. Virtually over a period of time, then he's going to make the suggestion that, hey, you know what? You know, it's very possible that maybe you blacked out and you just don't remember that you committed. Is that possible? He'll say, well, I guess so. I don't think so, but maybe. But 2.5 hours later of convincing, yeah, you're right. Maybe I did it when I was blacked out, because he minimized the culpability. Therefore, now he's admitting, saying that I blacked out during that. He gets it in writing, and the confession becomes absolute at that point.
Wow. Some people who confess to those things and they're found out to be innocent. Some cases, when someone was coerced into making a confession that wasn't true, they go to jail and they serve time. And then all of a sudden, someone will come forward and say, well, I did it. And then sometimes they don't even let the person who was accused the first time out of jail. They just stick with those evidence that they have on that person, and the other person just goes free. I've seen an incident like that. Mm-hmm. So what is that all about?
Well, what happens is that after conviction, there's a post-conviction element to it. It's called a habeas corpus. And what happens is there's three basic elements, or four, that basically allow somebody to go back and have the case relooked at again. And one of those things is newly found evidence not admitted at trial, ineffective assistance of counsel, newly found scientific evidence. And the fourth one is... let me think what the fourth one was. It's those three for sure. And then the ineffective assistance of counsel is usually the major one. And that's a legal question, by the way. So I'm just kind of walking through that. I do know it, but it's a legal element. That brings it back to the court. So the issue to bring it back, you have to prove these different types of things. And one of the things that, of course, you got to remember, by the time somebody gets convicted, they've either had a public defender that perhaps they were one of 150 cases that the public defender had and wasn't all that motivated to get him experts, a proper defense. Even though he got the minimum defense, he may not have got a completely proper defense, which he should have. Or they may have been, the family may have raised money, spent $30,000, $35,000 on a lawyer, and that lawyer basically then eventually took a plea because he didn't spend any money on experts and trying to actually present the case in a proper way. Happens all the time. So then comes down, they've already used up a lot of their funding. Families, once again, are going out looking for an attorney to bring it back for a habeas corpus petition. That may be unsuccessful or may be successful. It's a lot of these types of cases, when it gets down to a point where you've got a certain person that now is sitting there saying, well, I was the one who did it. These are the types of issues that I always suggest to people that are clients that call my office. First of all, if you don't have an attorney, I really am not going to give you legal advice. I'm not an attorney. So what I am telling them, though, is what you should do is contact the Justice Department. And they have an integrity unit in the Justice Department. And the integrity unit then looks, if it's that cut and dry where there was mistakes made, there was improper activities by the prosecutor or by even the attorney, the DOJ integrity unit can take a look at it. And that doesn't cost a dime, but they take very few cases, and they have to be very good before they'll take them. And the other part is go to the Innocence Project. I mean, the Innocence Project then will take it back to the court and argue certain elements. And they deal specifically with DNA issues. And by the way, just so you're aware of it, in the statistics-wise, in the Innocence Project statistics, is that out of all the exonerations that come out of DNA, which are people that are exonerated from crimes, 25% of those are from also include false confessions. So people are motivated and to give confessions when they believe either there's a no-hope situation, there's potentially a lower bar set for what they might get in the elements, that they may get only 5 years and then they get 50 years when they go into court. This is done all the time. I get these cases daily. I probably get 7-8 calls a day just on this alone. So that's just one element there.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, what about faulty identifications of suspects occur? How does that happen?
Okay, so there's an article out I've written called The Dominant Witness Theory. And the dominant witness theory simply means this. It simply means that when police go to a multi-witness event, the issue really is when they ask a witness, what did you see? The first thing that's the first question they'll ask a witness. And the witness will then go on and tell them what they believe they saw. What the officer should be asking is, who did you speak to before I arrived? Because the dominant witness that's there, but talking to the other witnesses well before the police even get there, have already integrated their narrative into the other witnesses. So, oh yes, it was a black car. I saw the car, it was blue. No, it wasn't, it was black. Really? Okay. So then when the police get there, it was black. So now everybody is on the same page, and that's why sometimes the witness statements will all coincide with each other. When I was an officer back then, I used to specifically ask, who did you speak to before I arrived? And they would say, well, we spoke amongst each other. And I would suggest to them that, you know what, I bet you really know what happened, but you were kind of scared to ask, to tell anybody, correct? And they'd say, well, I kind of thought I was, I made a mistake, but everybody's saying it's a black car, and I'm pretty sure it was blue. Really? Okay. And that individual, just like an identification of a suspect, may have the idea that they saw something. I used to do these lectures that I was testing my theory on, the dominant witness theory. And I put 30 people into a room. I did this about maybe 25 times. And when I first used to go into the room, I'd leave up on the overhead, I'd leave three pictures or mugshots of three looking suspects. And they're real mugshots. And I wouldn't come into the room for about maybe 15 minutes. And I would let them just, they don't know why it's up there. They're just looking at them. And then I'd leave the room and I'd come back in again and I'd just take them right off of the overhead. And then I'd suggest to them, I'd appeal to their egos and I'd say, look, I bet you nobody in here has good recall. How many people here think they got really good recall? And of course, everybody wants to have good recall. And so I would say, all right, I bet you nobody though saw the tattoo on suspect number two's lower neck in a hexagon shape. What have I just done? I've integrated a description of what I'm saying that they believed. And they all, five or six of them, say, I saw it. And then I leave the room, I'll say, I got to take a phone call, I'll be right back. And I listen to them. And they're arguing amongst each other who saw what. And by the time I get back in there, 15 of them have seen the hexagon shape of the tattoo. I then talk about something else for about 20, 30 minutes. And I come back in and I'd say, look, you guys amaze me. And I hit their egos once again. I said, you guys amaze me. But I bet you nobody saw the two dots and the third dot on the bottom of the hexagon tattoo. And I'd leave the room, pretend I was, I had to do something. And I'd come back and I'd be listening to them. And once again, arguing. At least five out of that group now remembered the tattoo and the dots and the hexagon shape and the image right down to the description. Then I'd come in and I'd take all the, put back up the three pictures. And I'd be accused of putting up the wrong picture. They believe in their minds that there was in fact a tattoo. They knew the description of it. And they really believe that they saw that. And that's how the dominant witness theory works.
Wow. Yeah, because that also reminds me of, you know, how a little game we used to play in school where you whisper something in somebody's ear, you have these people lined up, and by the time it gets to the last person, the story's so twisted.
Right,
on the
exactly.
First person who started it.
Yep,
yeah.
That's exactly correct. And so the idea of that, if you take that in a more serious scenario and you put that same scenario amongst police officers listening to witnesses, if they're not careful, they can get wrapped up into not only the fact targeting the wrong suspect because maybe one suspect has or one person has a real bad attitude and right away that officer doesn't like that individual and starts targeting him as a suspect, mistaking what he was doing is, sure, the guy may be angry, he may have had a real attitude, he may have been maybe even had been out of control on the scene, but that doesn't mean he committed a crime. But because you have a predisposition of certain types of people as a police officer, you have to be careful that you don't start bunching everybody into the same bulk and that you follow the evidence, you don't follow your dramatic elements.
Well, that's really something. So we already know the difference between an interview and interrogation. Is there anything more you'd like to add to that?
Well,
the difference between interview and interrogation.
Well, no, there's not really much.
I had always. Mm-hmm.
I mean,
I always thought that, you know, interview and interrogation, when the police do that, that it was the same thing. So I just learned something new as well.
Right. But there's some specific elements in an interrogation. When I'm looking at the video of an interrogation, for example, there's a couple of things that are different. Okay, so sometimes interrogations start off as interviews, which means there's a table in the room, a standard interview room, two chairs, usually at the corners. Now, what happens, and they're writing notes and they're talking to the potential accused person, which they believe is already a suspect, but that individual believes he's just a witness helping them in some cases. What ends up happening and what visually looks like an interrogation is when the officer puts down his notes, puts down the pen, moves the chair within the 2-foot range into the person in the person's space, personal space. That's when it's an interrogation visually. Now, an interrogation is also an interrogation just on the accusatory nature. Now, you could have officers that are not trained in doing proper interrogations, and they'll start doing basically an interrogation without the visuals. In other words, they'll leave their chairs where they are, but they'll be accusatory in nature. Those are still classed as interrogations because they're no longer accepting information and gathering information in the interview process, like the interview process. Some interrogations start off with interview visually. They're asking questions about certain things, but they already know where they're going to go with this. So they already know that when they go in that room, that individual will be taken down a path, and that path will be what that officer wants them to be done. And if he's a good interrogator, he's going to start using specific methods and techniques that are going to basically extract a confession. The purpose of an interview versus an interrogation, an interview is to extract information. An interrogation is to extract a confession. Big differences.
Because
you already believe you already know because you have what's known as the presumption of guilt, which is the requirement for going into the interrogation. But that's not how the accused person will think about it. They'll walk in thinking that perhaps if they're not in custody, they're there to answer questions. Perhaps in more of an interview scenario where they can assist the police, and everybody wants to assist the police. So the more they keep answering questions, the more that it's going to get more into the accusatory. They're going to set the stage for, oh, you did know that information. Oh, well then, so what was your relationship with this? And blah, blah, blah. And then they go on and on. And that slowly basically turns into an interrogation. It segues itself right in that.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Sure.
You're listening to If Life Gives You Lemons, Make a Martini Show at 109.9 Blog Talk Radio, coming to you live from Fayetteville, North Carolina. Hosted by Gail St. Francis Johnson, formerly known as Miss Delicious. For questions or comments, the call-in number is 646-652-2877. That's 646-652-2877. And remember, if life gives you lemons, make a martini. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the show.
All right. This is your host, Gail St. Francis, back. I want to make a little shout-out to everybody that's on the switchboard, and I want to say a special shout-out to my sister, Ruby. How are you, darling? We're going to get right back with, because this show is kind of short, but we're going to get it as much information as we can before we let Bryant go. Now, how far police investigations are responsible for charging the wrong suspects?
What was the question one more time?
How flawed police investigators are responsible for charging the wrong suspects?
Charging the wrong suspects is totally based on a police investigation. As you can appreciate, it's up to the officer and their ability to do a proper investigation. If an officer goes in, and here's a good example of that. If you are an officer, and let's say, for instance, you're going to domestics regularly, and those are investigations in their own right, and as a result of it, you really have a distaste for individuals, males that strike females, let's say, for instance, and you're an officer that goes into that scenario. You already go in there with a predisposition. So chances are you're probably going to walk out of there with the male in handcuffs. And if he's not, then you're probably assuming that he committed these offenses that were allegations were made. But you're basing that on, number one, your own personal bias, and secondly, not necessarily on evidence. And because you've got an individual that's a victim in that case, or an alleged victim that's making allegations, because certain people are crying, you're assuming that that is going to be authentic. And so based on that, you're not going to make choices based necessarily on hard evidence, and you're not going to probably, because you have these biases, not going to go any further to see if there's anything that contradicts. It's going to be something that is basically corroborating the information you have to go into a charge. So based on that, you really haven't done an investigation. You haven't covered all the angles. You can't assume by going into an investigation that everybody you're speaking to is telling you the truth, that they saw what they saw, that they are giving you the information. They may have a stake in it that you have no idea. And if you don't check that out, how do you authenticate the credibility of a witness or as a victim? You have to be sure, because the people that you're charging, and keep in mind, I was an officer for 14 years and a chief for two. And I went out of my way to ensure that I did a complete investigation. And even though I was under pressure sometimes by the prosecutor's office, get these charges late, I wouldn't do it. I needed to know the truth. I needed to know the facts, and I needed to know the evidence. And I walked into every case, and it was like going to the gym every day. I had to remove any predisposition I might have about anything in my mind when I walked into it. And I always tried to do that. And no matter how angry that individual might be, that might say this has got to be the suspect, I would ignore that and just look at the evidence, because more than enough times that was the case. If you didn't look at the evidence, you don't have a case.
Wow. So, you know, I've been in a situation, I really wasn't interrogated, but I was in a situation where something had went down and I was in court. And the police officer that was involved, he outright lied, you know, but fortunately the case had went in my favor. But, you know, I knew he had lied, but for some reason, he got away with the lie. But like I said, I came out, you know, out of the situation. The person that was, you know, involved came out of the situation. But, you know, that's another problem that, you know, I think should be addressed as well. Especially, well, you know, he's not going to admit it. The police would never admit that he lied. But the client or whatever will be accused of something, and he knows the truth, and the police lied on him. So when are situations like that ever addressed?
Sure. They're addressed all the time. The problem is that are the lawyers equipped to do proper cross-examination? The issue really becomes that you've got to remember, and I mean, police officers are human, okay? Just like a child, when you get into trouble, what's the first thing a child does when they get into trouble?
They get scared.
They lie.
So
when a police officer does something, perhaps he didn't cross his T's or dot his I's, and now it's exposed, his ego is 100%, and he's not going to want to expose that, because he's now going to have to say, oh, I screwed up. That's not something that human beings generally like to do, never mind people that are police officers. So lying is not, I wouldn't say, overly common, but it happens. And it happens for those reasons a lot of the time. There's a lot of, you know, in the interrogation room, that's why everything is videotaped or supposed to be videotaped. When I look at interrogations and I look at interviews with witnesses and alleged victims, I watch all the time how specific elements are taken. For example, in interrogations, there was one interrogation that was that I looked at. It took me an hour, and I called the attorney back and I said, look, on the time code burns on the windows of the interrogation, there was 47 edits into the seconds of the time codes, which means that it had been edited, 36 minutes missing of the actual copy that the lawyer had. And right away, that pretty much ended the case. The issue was, the claim was that, you know what, it was just a bad camera. You know, this is what when the attorney went back to court to find out what's going on here. Oh, but you know what? I also looked at two other witness statements, the interviews that were done in that same room that night, and not one of them had a second missing. So what does that tell you? These are not overly common, but what has to happen is people just need to say, do your job in the beginning, take your proper notes when you do it, and there's no need to have to cover yourself later if you're not making mistakes. And if you do make mistakes, you are human. You can be forgiven. You're not one of these people that is expected to have everything. You can say, well, you know what? I'm really not sure about that. I don't really know that. I wish I had marked it down on the night of, but I didn't a year and a half ago at this scene. Yes, I should have maybe signed that in the chain of custody. I didn't, but I do feel comfortable that nobody touched it. These are things you can say. And you know what? You've got a lot more credibility in the courts. But once again, what happens with judges, and not in every case. I mean, there's lots of judges that don't believe anything a lot of police officers say. But there's also judges that, because they're police officers, will automatically believe because they have integrity. It's called police culture. Police culture, only police know what other police do. Okay? They don't go around telling everybody outside. I mean, you take a look at even cases of you know, in the O.J. Simpson case and places like that, with, you know, certain individuals had done things that they made huge mistakes but weren't willing to admit it. And then when they're caught doing something, they're not going to admit it under oath necessarily. So they're lying, of course. But if it's only them, no one's corroborating it. So that's the problem, is that now that's one of the reasons why you have, you know, you have cameras on the officers, you have cameras in the cars, you have cameras in the interrogation rooms, you have cameras everywhere to capture that. But even those can be altered and edited. And that's what I look for. I look for that all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I heard someone say that guilty people generally hire lawyers. But is it necessary or is it important, whether you're guilty or not, to have a lawyer?
No. In fact, opposite that. guilty people aren't necessarily people that hire lawyers. Guilty people should hire lawyers, absolutely. But everybody should hire lawyers. And if you don't have one, you should have one appointed. Because the fact is that to maneuver around these types of things, you don't know how many people will be convinced in taking a polygraph. And in a, you know, that they said, well, I didn't do anything. And, well, are you prepared to take a polygraph? Absolutely. Well, what do you think happens in the polygraph? You're talking about questions that are going to be narrative traps. No matter how you answer it, you're going to show deception.
Wow.
The last thing you want to do is take a polygraph. I even tell attorneys, don't even send your client to a friendly polygraph.
So that's why they don't use the polygraph in court, because it's not
accurate. It's not accurate.
Right.
It's flawed. It's flawed.
Mm-hmm.
And if it wasn't flawed, they would be using it.
I knew this guy one time. He said he was taught how to fool the polygraph machine. So when he said he had lied, but you know everything had came out that you know positive when he took it. So is that possible that someone could learn or is taught how to deceive a polygraph test?
Sure. So sociopaths can pass it with flying colors. I'll tell you a story. This is a story actually going back to my police. And I remember I was doing a sexual assault case, and this woman had come to me saying that, you know, she'd been taken in the garage by this individual and you know, he had not raped her, but sexually assaulted her. So at that particular time in my career, I was still kind of playing with the witnesses and trying to figure out, you know, how do I work out how to believe witnesses? And I had a methodology I was using called reaction analysis profiling. In fact, I've written 3 books based on that. And the issue really then became, she came in, she gave me a complete statement, no problem. It was 100%. It was nice, full of detail. She knew times, dates, etc. There was no question. There was no reason to question her. I said to her again, which I always used to do that, I need to see you again in about 2 weeks. And I went back through the interview again, and I got her to tell me the story again. And because generally speaking, if you go from middle to end, beginning to the middle, and switch it up a little bit, there's going to be some inconsistencies. No, there was very few inconsistencies. Like, she knew her stuff. And I said to her, because at that time I was a chief of police, I could do this. I couldn't do it as when I was an officer. But I said to her, you know what? I have no reason to doubt her except for my own methodology was showing that she was deceptive. And I said, I'd like you to go down to the polygraph unit and I'll make arrangements to have a polygraph done, if you want to. I mean, she's a victim. She doesn't have to do anything. She doesn't even have to do it as an accused. So she said, well, absolutely, I'll go. I'd love to go. Most officers at that point would say, okay, never mind then. And I said, go ahead. And so she did, and they called me that night, and they said, Chief, she's totally telling the truth. Everything she said was totally accurate. We have no doubt to disbelieve her. I said, what was the polygraph? And they said, the polygraph showed it was broken at the time, so we just basically interrogated her for 3 hours. I said, not a good enough. I need the polygraph. So they did it about a week later. She went down again, no problem, signed off on everything. And this is a victim we're talking about, not even an accused. But if they lied, they'd be an accused. So automatically, they called me back that night and said, Chief, she lied about everything. She gave us a full confession. And I said, let me tell you something. I'll guarantee you that polygraph showed that she passed. They said, you're right, Chief. And we just lied to her and told her she failed, and she came clean with everything. She was a sociopath.
That is serious, though, you know, for someone to be that way, because, you know, you could cause harm to other people as far as, like, lying on them, you know, and then making it so believable, because so many women have cried rape or cried this and cried that, and then come to find out none of it happened.
Well,
you know, and that makes it bad for women that it actually happened to.
True, yes, and this is the problem. But what happens is we get into this culture now of we must believe every victim without question, unconditionally. That's absolute nonsense. Because
yeah.
if you understood what I understand and what I know through my experience, that you're going to find that as long as you do your job as an officer and question and figure ways to basically corroborate or not corroborate their statements and follow up and investigate certain things and walk in with an empty mind, you will get the answers you want. And it'll be fair for the victims. The victims who basically are real are going to come out as real. The ones that are making it up, they have reasons for that. And those reasons have to be followed up. You wouldn't believe how many cases I go to when I'm testifying and even when I'm looking at them doing analysis, even on sex offense cases in particular, how many of them had motives for making allegations. These were never investigated. They were just accepted as if they supposedly were supposed to accept them. And that's why when I do reports, my reports are, I look at every phrase, every word that is said in that interrogation room or that interview room, and I have ways of knowing whether there's an integrated narrative being given by the interviewer into even witnesses. And you know, you would be surprised how many techniques of basically coercive techniques are used on witnesses to come straight with the narrative that the officer wants. And it's not because they purposely are trying to have misconduct. These officers believe that they know what they're doing, and they're edging or basically getting the witnesses to and putting words in their mouth when they don't even realize they're doing that. And this is where good interview techniques need to be had by the interviewers. And we're talking about even street level officers that take quick statements off people on non-felony cases, even where people get charged. And these are the kinds of training that need to be given to these officers, because these officers need to know how to do proper investigations and learn to see and ask specific questions when somebody gives you an answer. You should already know that if you have an open mind to this individual, to every individual, you'll ask them specific questions they won't be able to answer because they don't know the truth.
Well, I have a question that may be a little off board, but the police today, it seems that they're they're going through something, or you know, because people are getting killed who are unarmed and being killed because they're running away and you know, breaking in, well, busting people's doors down and things like that. So who is policing the police, and how come, you know, these things are called justifiable when in my eyes, and I don't know, well, a lot of other people see the same thing. So how does that become justifiable for police to shoot an unarmed man who is running away? I mean, I can understand if you shot him in the leg or, you know, the stomach, but to shoot him in the head, you know, in the chest, and, you know, such things as that. So what is, you know, what's going on with that?
Okay, first of all, a lot of people think this is just new. This has just started to happen in the last 5 years. It's not. It's been going on for years.
Oh, I know.
It's been going on for years.
Right.
But nobody
looks worse now.
But
yeah.
No, it's not worse. It's the same. But no one believed it back in those days. There was always justification for everything. What has to happen in policing generally is police officers, and I'm not going to comment on use of force. Use of force is what their training is, what the law allows. That's different. They have to be accountable when something like that happens. And unfortunately, it does happen. And one of those reasons is very based information. These officers are not knowledgeable of their communities, period. when you work your communities and you get to know the people in your communities and you make a point of getting to know the people in your community, especially if you're a street officer, there's no reason, you sure
right.
you got called, but there's no reason why you can't get to know everybody, why you can't be approachable.
Right,
you know?
But you don't, you rarely see police officers walking a beat nowadays. Because I remember growing up seeing the police, you know, they would come into the neighborhood and,
sure.
you know, talk with the kids and make friends,
sure.
officer friendly. You know, but now you rarely see them, you know, walking a beat. You may
yeah,
see them on a bicycle,
yeah.
motorcycle, but they're not walking
and when they
anymore.
And when they are walking the beat, they're talking to owners of businesses. That's all fine. But what about your neighborhoods? What about your when you walk into specific areas that are kind of, you know, basically challenged areas where they have people that, you know, are on fixed incomes and people that are struggling? These are people that you need to get to know, because half the time they can't know where their kids are all the time. There's gangs in certain areas. And that's why you have gang units, but the gang units are there to do enforcement mostly, not to stop kids from getting into gangs or prevent that. Policing is not about enforcement 100%. It's more like 40% enforcement and the rest of it about preventing. And if you understand that going in, and one of the things that I've always told people, you know, as a chief of police, in this day and age, if I was to take on another police job again, one of the criteria would be every officer, when they start in the department, has to have 1 year as their probation. And during that probationary period, they have to create a program in a vulnerable neighborhood. And it has to be a program that works. And once you've done that, you then get to graduate.
Wow. Well, I wish you were the chief of police again.
No, I tell you,
but
it worked. I did it every day. And I made a point. And when I went into, sure, I arrested people all the time. I had a good arrest record. But one of the reasons why I had a good arrest record is everybody knew I was fair. And I already knew the information because people would talk to me. So I'd go to them and say, look, you guys, when are you guys going to come clean with this stuff and are going to tell me about it? Yeah, okay. And they would come over and they'd tell me about it. I'd say, okay, look it. I'm going to charge you with this, this, and this, but that's it. But you know, this is your first opportunity to clean up yourself. And I used to be involved in programs all the time. You know, this is where you have to be a police officer. And it's not about enforcement. Sure, you can enforce all you want, but if you don't know the people you're enforcing and people that you're going in those neighborhoods, you won't know what's really going on. You'll know what you think is going on.
That is the truth. That is the truth. And if they could get back to, you know, having the policemen walking the beat, and then some of the police officers, well, I remember growing up, a police officer had to be fit. He had to be able to do this, do that, and whatever, whatever. And I've seen a video today where this guy was, he was in court, and he was running out. And two policemen were chasing him. One of the policemen jumped over the banister and fell down the steps, and he had broken ribs and this and that. And the other one, he was limping, you know. So I'm just saying, a lot of these officers are really not in the shape that they need to be in to be out on the streets chasing people. Because
yeah.
if you're 300-400 pounds, there's no way in the world you can chase somebody 20-21 down the street. So what you gonna do? Pull your gun out and shoot, you know.
Yeah.
So it needs to be.
Look at and
it
if
needs
you
to
knew
be.
And if you knew your neighborhoods well enough, you wouldn't have to shoot anybody because you'd know who that person was.
Right, that is true. But they just,
and
they
listen to
they
you,
just,
and they listen to you probably because they respect you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I don't know how many times that I used to go to calls all the time when I was in uniforms and things like that, and I'd walk to into a noisy party, and I would knock on the door and they'd know who I was. They'd say, "Oh, Brian's here." Yeah, guys, you got to go now. Okay, we're out of here. Bye. Good. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
But no,
well, you used to be like that growing up as well, because the police, they would talk to you, you know, and, you know, talk things out. And if you had to be arrested, you turn around and give them your hands or whatever.
Exactly.
You know, but now they're being so persistent and, defiant, and it's all because of fear.
Yeah, but let me clarify a couple of things here. First of all, there is a lot of good officers out there, okay? And
I know
because I was one that I made a point of whenever I was training a rookie of any kind, I would train them to know their neighborhoods well. That's, I mean, there was a lot of great officers that did a lot of great things and still do to this day. And but these are not the people that get in the media because the media doesn't care. Those are the ones that you know, you'll see them going in the neighborhoods. You'll see them knowing their neighborhoods well, and they enjoy their jobs because they know the people in their neighborhood. I used to call them clients.
Mm-hmm.
The people in my neighborhood were called clients. I called them clients.
Right.
One of my clients has a problem.
I really hate to cut you short, but we only have 4 minutes left, and
the
show went by really quick. Yeah, because I scheduled it for an hour. You wanted 45 minutes. I did an hour. But
sure.
Let everybody know how they can get in touch with you, or if you have any books out, or, you know, if you want contact with people, can you give them that information so they can contact you? Or
sure, yeah. I mean, all my clients, the people that call me regularly, I always have time to talk to them. Unlike some attorneys, everything goes to voicemail. I talk to everybody. So you can always get a hold of me, 1-888-400-1309, or you can go to, I have a website that is basically for convicted people. It's called convictedhub.com. That's convictedhub.com. And all my information you can get there.
All right, so I noticed you had a book as well. Do you want to speak about that?
Yeah, sure. I've got 3 books. Two of them that I've still got for sale. They're e-books right now. Basically, one's called The Deception of a Witness. The other's called, oh my God, just a second. I got to think about the other. I never promote them, so. Well, they're on my website anyway. You'll see them, but I don't usually promote them, so I don't. They're e-books now. They used to be out in print quite a while ago. So it was based on reaction analysis profiling, which is what I wrote the books about. Deception of a Witness is about people that were wrongfully convicted.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, what is that book available? Or
You can get them through Barnes & Noble. Sure.
Oh, okay. So it's in a bookstore or
sure.
The internet.
Oh, well, yeah. They're on. You can buy them online. Yeah, they're e-books.
Oh, okay. And what's the title of it again?
Yeah. So the both of them are. One of them's called "Deception of a Witness." The other one's, I remember, "Visual Liar."
Okay, deception.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, that sounds really good. Well, Brian, I really do appreciate you coming on this show, and I'm quite sure my listeners did as well. And if you have any other endeavors or any you'd like to come back, you know, just get in touch with me. I really would appreciate that. Mm-hmm. And we're going to give you a great big round of applause.
Thank you.
Yes, we are. That's how we treat our good guests here.
Thanks. Well, I appreciate that.
Yes. Okay, Brian, like I said, anytime you want to come back, you know how to get in touch with me, and I know how to get in touch with you. And I do appreciate you for coming on, and I'm quite sure my listeners did. They were so quiet on the switchboard, I guess. I don't know, people come on and they don't want to say anything, but I am glad that they listen, you know. So.
Sure.
And I hope to get some knowledge as far as, you know, interrogation and interviews and the way different things that we spoke about. I hope they grasp that information. And if you guys are listening and you'd like to go get his book, it's at Barnes & Noble. Plus, you can order it over the internet. And with that being said, I'm going to say good night to you, Brian. Good night to my listeners. And everybody, remember, this is the weekend, so don't drink and don't drive. If you're driving, don't drink. I like talking to you, not about you. I like seeing you, not viewing you. And I'd like to ask the listeners, as well as yourself, Brian, to pray for one of my spiritual sisters who was killed in a car accident on Tuesday. So, you know, please keep her in prayer. And another one of my sisters suffered from cancer of the brain.
Oh, no.
So, you know, with that being said, I'm asking all the prayer warriors to pray for them and, you know, the family that my sister left behind who was killed in a horrific car accident. So,
oh, no.
You know, we're all going to die one day, but, you know, it's sad when someone kills you.
That's
and,
right.
Okay, so everybody have a nice weekend. See you guys probably next week. And, Brian, you have a great weekend as well. And, again, thank you very much for being on.
No, I enjoyed it.
Talk.
Yeah, I enjoyed
it. Life gives you lemon, make a martini. All right, guys, good night. Love you.
All right, good night.
You just listened to the number one radio station on the Internet, Delicious Talk Radio. Thank you and good night.